I can't walk into like any place in which I have experience and say, hey, can I work there? Because it would be difficult for me to ask that. So I realized, okay, I need to be able to find something that enables me to work remotely internationally, because like I want to continue to travel. And from that, I discovered these digital nomad visas. And this was kind of like, they had been around. So like Portugal had been around, but they'd really blossomed since early, 2020, since COVID. And they were popping up like crazy. There's a few more. Costa Rica today just officially launched theirs, because they had announced that they were going to today. They just launched theirs. And I realized after market research, there's no one in this space doing what it is that I want to do. And at that point, I just went full in, found my partner, and we can talk about that. And now we're here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the GMI Rocket Show. I'm your host, Roman Zelichenko. I'm a former immigration attorney turned entrepreneur. I am the co-founder of Laborless, which is an immigration tech startup that automates H-1B visa compliance, and also the founder of GMI Rocket, which is a digital marketing agency for the immigration space, and of course also brings you this show. Really excited for today's episode. We're on episode number 79, and we're going to dive into a segment of immigration, global immigration, really, that we haven't really touched on before in the show, and that's really kind of only been around for a few years. And that is going to be the digital nomad visa. So our guest today is the co-founder of a company called Citizen Remote. Our guest is Tim Marting, who is really helping revolutionize how individuals around the world really interact with digital nomad visas for purposes of sort of living somewhere for a short period of time as a freelancer or as a digital nomad. We'll get into that in a bit. Being able to experience the world without the traditional kind of work visa route. So I'm really excited to explore this conversation. I'm excited to dive into kind of where digital nomad visas are going and how technology can help make the world sort of more accessible in that sense. So with that, Tim, thank you so much for being here. And I'm really pumped for our conversation. I appreciate it.
Cheers. Thanks, Ron. I'm pretty pumped to be on the show, man.
And I know you're in Spain right now. And it's evening time for you. So appreciate you, you know, taking your Friday evening to chat with me and us and, you know, share your journey and everything you guys are doing with Citizen Remote.
Yeah, man, it's 7 o'clock, but you know, dinner is not till about 10:30 over here, so I got plenty of time.
That's awesome. So, Tim, you know, I want to know about how you got to Spain, and that's going to be a big part of the journey, right? Of you as an entrepreneur and a co-founder of a company that deals with sort of immigration and travel technology. I love to start in the beginning. You know, it's funny because when we spoke, I asked you initially, well, I know you attended Kansas State University, and I asked you if you were an international student. For some reason, I guess I'm used to talking to founders who immigrated for studying or for work into the US, whatever country they're in. But of course, you know, you're born and raised in the US. You were born in Kansas City, Missouri. So I'm from New York. So can you tell me a little bit about kind of, I don't know, what was it like for you growing up in the Midwest? What kind of a kid were you? Were you like entrepreneurial or super studious or rebellious or something? Just who was Tim kind of before you, who you are today?
Oh God, that's that can go a bunch of different directions.
Sure.
I'll stick to the, I was quite entrepreneurial as a kid. I know that one of the things that I did, I always knew I was going to go entrepreneurial route. I didn't know that there was going to be an entrepreneur degree. So that was kind of exciting when I found that out after doing a few years of accounting. But when I first started and knew that I was going to be an entrepreneur, it was kind of that, not lemonade stand, but I had a slushy maker and I made like actual slushies, and it was like super popular and all of the kids just loved it. And my dad, who isn't quite the entrepreneur, but he is a financial guru, I'd say. He is actually a CFO. So he kind of walked me through, all right, great. You've made money this weekend, you know, the first time. And I was so excited. And he's like, so next weekend when we do this, you owe money for the syrups, you owe money for the ice and the electricity that it costs to run it. Hmm. And I was like, well, then I'm not going to make money. And he was like, welcome to business. And I was like, okay. Wow. So that was kind of a little bit of my upbringing, and don't think my father's a bad guy. He was an excellent human being, but it was, you know, one of those things that I had the benefit of kind of that leadership growing up. And then that kind of just led me on my path to a whole heap of things. But yeah, I guess that's the beginning of my childhood.
And how old were you when you had this sort of slushy stand and had this conversation? Because I think to your point, you know, it, not that it comes off as it doesn't come off as mean at all. It's like a lesson, opportunity to learn a lesson. But of course, it is pretty like, do you wait a couple times? And it's like right away he said, okay, well, that was your revenue. That wasn't just your money. You know, here are your costs. And by the way, I'm your landlord. I'm your supplier, right? I'm your net.
He didn't charge me rent, but no. I think he let me keep all of the earnings that I made. And I think he let me do it a few times. But of course, in my mind, I remember it being like, oh, well, now I'm not going to do this anymore. But yeah, no. So it was good. Yeah. I forgot what you initially just asked. So
I was wondering how old were you when you had that kind of conversation?
I want to say like 7 or 8. So really young, yeah.
That's amazing. And you know, that kind of lesson really stuck with you, right? Because that's great. And, you know, to your point, maybe he was not an entrepreneur, but as the CFO, you know, executive of a company, you have to think like the owner of the organization, you know, I suspect that having him around for those kind of lessons was fantastic. So after the slushy stand, I mean, I'm curious, did you, you know, throughout like middle school, high school, did you do any more of those types of things? Or was that sort of like a fun experience when you're younger? And then you're like, all right, let me kind of go to school and do the whole traditional thing.
Yeah, no, from that, I wouldn't say it like killed my spirit, because I did like mowing, like lawn mowing. I always tried to figure out any way to make money. And then obviously when I went into like later high school and university, I just got a job. But I mean, all throughout up until probably high school, so like 14, I was always trying to figure out the weirdest ways, whether it's like finding stuff in the dumpster and selling it and finding any way I could to make money. So, and I guess the thing that comes like, yeah, my father was the CFO, but when I was younger, you know, he didn't have the job like that he had by the time. So he wasn't a CFO when that conversation took place. And so he grew up, he funded his own way through college and all that. And, you know, so he took that pretty seriously, getting to where he was at as a child to where he ended up in life. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, those life lessons were really beneficial to see, especially from my childhood to where I know the family is now. You know, it was good to kind of be on both ends.
That's awesome. Yeah. And, you know, obviously instilling that in you, right, versus sort of like him being the one working harder than you get to just enjoy, if you will. That's really cool. You know, so it sounds like you were kind of doing a little bit of this sort of entrepreneurial work, and then obviously got a job like many of us in high school and university. And you went to Kansas State University, and you studied accounting and as well as entrepreneurship. Is that right?
So I did accounting for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Transferred universities for 1 year. So was still doing accounting. But then when I transferred back to K-State, because, you know, there was a girl, like the start of every story. When I transferred back to K-State, they said none of those accounting classes will apply towards the accounting degree. And I was like, well, I don't want to take all of those. It was like tax accounting. And I was like, I'm not doing that again. Like, I'm just not. And so at that point, a good buddy of mine growing up was like, have you explored entrepreneurship? And then that's when I said, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing. And so I have an emphasis in accounting, but it's definitely entrepreneurship for sure.
Got it. So some of those credits actually rolled over for the entrepreneurship.
Business credits were lost, but it was just quicker because like way that it worked was, yeah, maybe it was some of them, but the way it worked was either way, it was quicker to graduate with the entrepreneurship degree. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to get done considering I essentially lost a year without losing a year.
I guess my question to you about that would be, what do you feel? I mean, and I'd love to come back to this, you know, when we start talking about, you know, your experience now building Citizen Remote. What did you learn as an entrepreneur? And I'm asking this kind of genuinely because I studied financial economics and philosophy in college. I always like had I always had a lot of business ideas, but I never formally kind of learned it in school. Mm-hmm. But of course, I've now gone through it in real life. And so I always wonder if I had studied any sort of entrepreneurship or sort of general business in school and in university, if it would be helpful to me. Do you remember anything, any courses? Like, was there anything that stuck out for you from that time?
Yeah, there were two courses that I remember specifically in regards to entrepreneurship. So pretty much the rest of the degree is, base understanding, almost like a business administration, a base understanding of a little bit of everything. Because as an entrepreneur, you'll learn, you need to know a little bit of everything. So the two courses that stuck out were an entrepreneurial consulting course, just essentially kind of walked you through like the Lean Startup, if you've ever read that book, almost like that, but then a focus on those startups, just how to get a business off the ground, what to expect. And then, so that course was really beneficial that, you know, you don't get in every course necessarily because they teach you how to get into an already developed company most of the time. But the other course was one, it was like a test course that I believe they're still doing. And it was amazing because they essentially brought four different very successful like CEOs that were K-State alumni who have these really great companies now. And they literally taught, you know, one quarter of the half year course. And the stories that they said, the insight that they brought was just great. It's like sitting down and picking the brain of somebody who did it all and, you know, where they screwed up, where they would suggest you do stuff. And that was my favorite course probably in university for sure.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's almost, that's fantastic. And you had to have access to those people. When I was in, I didn't quite have that experience in college or in university, but in law school, a few of my immigration law courses were taught by practitioners who were practicing at that time. One of whom was a professor named Cyrus Mehta, who's like a big, thinker and writer in the immigration law space and just a really, really brilliant and also just nice guy. But he would very often, our class was basically reading like his law firm blog because it was so detailed. It was effectively a textbook. But what was really cool was he would come back from work sometimes, he would go from work to the school to teach, and he would quite literally share sort of ongoing cases or cases that were just resolved, or a visa that was granted or denied or whatnot. And it was so cool because it felt that what we were learning was real. Like he would, he would say, "Hey, here's something that's happening right now. How do you think?" I mean, shoot, maybe he was even outsourcing some of the legal strategy to the students, but it was so exciting to think about something, not theoretically and not like, well, how would you have done this for this 100-year-old, issue?
Yeah.
It was like, no, I'm dealing with this right now. What do you think? Right. Mm-hmm. And just that in and of itself made it more exciting to learn and to know that there's application to what you're learning in school. And so I feel like it's so memorable to, what a great opportunity to be able to talk to these CEOs and pick their brain.
Yeah. Well, and I think, the way that school's taught a lot is that there's an answer to everything. Mm-hmm. And when you get into the real world, there's like almost an answer for nothing. I mean, obviously there are the base answers, but then everything else, it's like, figure it out. There's no direct, this is the right direction. It's especially in entrepreneurship. What are we doing tomorrow? So
that's a great point. And also, how do you even grade yourself in the real world? Like something might feel like a failure now, but 6 months or a year later, it might come back around and be a huge success, from a business development standpoint or a marketing standpoint. And then you realize that, it's such a cliche, but, losing or failing isn't always what it seems. And very often it's either a learning moment or it is an opportunity that just hasn't flourished yet. And so then you're like, well, what's the point sort of business school, if you will, but obviously there are a lot of benefits, but in any case, this is not an education podcast. So maybe we can go into that another time. I did want to jump in. We have one comment here from my good friend, Josh Shacknow. He says, "Happy Friday, guys. We'd love to hear about Tim's experience automating the immigration part, especially for multiple countries." So you've had this awesome experience at university. And obviously, again, sounds like you had some really great classes. You graduated, you worked in real estate for a little bit, and then you decided to travel the world, right? And so I want to talk about that decision a little bit. Because I think a lot of us, I mean, probably most of us graduate university. We have, if we're lucky enough to get a job, I mean, I graduated college in 2010 and I did go straight to law school, but I did have the opportunity to go work. And this was right after, this was 1 or 2 years after the height of the financial recession. And so, for most people, there was, having a job was just, that's what you do. You don't think until much later, like, wow, I was just grinding. Why didn't I give myself a little bit more flexibility, assuming that you can sort of afford it and don't have mouths to feed and whatnot. Yeah. So you had a job, you were working, right? What made you decide to want to like basically leave your job and travel?
So it was another startup as well, that I created. And it was essentially, I realized that it wasn't a passion. And that was so important to me because I could have gone the route of, all right, let me just get money and go find a job with a corporate, you know, whatever. And I could have done that route. My brother did that route. I saw my dad do that route. But a main influencer was, I saw my, as we were talking about, you know, my dad had a big impact in my life. And to see him in his time when we were younger, when, you know, he didn't have the responsibilities that he had by the end of his career. And maybe we didn't have as much money, but just the general amount of time he was able to spend with, you know, the family day to day, as opposed to at the end of his career, how much time he was able to spend. And he actually came to me, and this is what, you know, also influenced my company, and I would make a bunch more money. And what should I do? And he came to me, and I was like, well, if it was me, you have enough money to retire, because he did. And that was, you know, he had talked to, he was like, I have enough money to retire. So retire, like enjoy the life that, you know, like why grind a bit more and make that extra money when you already have enough to retire comfortably. And then he did that. And that was, you know, very influential. And then there was another conversation, I guess, as well. I know that I talked to you about that was essentially you can go that route and make that money and get to that point where my dad retired quicker. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get there any quicker than somebody who enjoyed those first few years of life, traveling right after university. And so having both of those conversations, I realized I want to travel now and I'll find out my career in a few years.
Do you think that, did you have friends who kind of went from university straight to work and you watched like their trajectory? Did you think to yourself, like, I don't want this?
Well, I don't know any of my friends who did what I did, but you know, all of my friends now are pretty well set up. Like, you know, they're on a second or third tier promotion, you know, and then, you know, my brother's 2 years older than me. He's got friends that are doing real well now, but you know, they went straight into their career, which is, you know, great and all, but I'm in a position to benefit nicely and I've kind of grinded to the extent. So I don't think that I'm any worse off via my decisions. And I guess, you know, the small benefit of being able to travel half the world is pretty nice. So.
Yeah. I always think about it from the perspective of someone in your position may look at somebody who has been working. And I mean, I had that too, right? When I left my job, although I wasn't necessarily traveling full time, but starting your own business when you leave a sort of set path is scary, quite just the same. You know you're putting your life on pause professionally, and you look at other folks who have continued, like you said, got promotions and not. But for the most part, I don't like really wish I was in their position. I just appreciate where they are. But yeah. And I mean this in the best possible way, but there are many people who would, on the flip side of it, look at me who's like doing my own business, or to your, you know, for you, you're traveling the world and really feel like, wow, I wish I was doing that. It sounds a little maybe arrogant or something, but when you go through that experience of talking to people who are still working and they're on that path and you know, feel good about it, and the emotion that they give you of saying like, wow, I really wish I was doing what you were doing, versus the emotion that you have towards them, which typically is not, wow, I really wish I was still in corporate and I really wish I had those extra two promotions. You know, the emotions there don't balance out. Typically, they feel that they wish truly that they had that freedom to travel or explore the world or explore a business opportunity. And so I feel like that makes me believe that this is the right decision, can make it.
Yeah. I mean, it's with its struggles as well. There's no, but I guess I'd also say to those people, and I do, because my friends say, how did you do that? And it's not difficult, one, but also they can still do that today, right? Which is the company that I'm, you know, building. Assuming that you have kind of a typical corporate life job, most of you can work remotely, travel the world. It's not done yet. Although you might have kids and a family, so that's a different scenario. But
although, hey, there's opportunities for that too. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about your travels, right? Because obviously your travels led you to, first of all around the world, and then second of all to eventually, you know, launching Citizen Remote. So talk to me a little bit about the sort of trajectory of your travels. I mean, I want to know, and don't, you know, you don't have to rush through it. I mean, so you went to the UK, right? From the US. Now, was that the first time you ever left the country?
No. So I went on family vacation twice, one to Mexico, one to Costa Rica. But this was the first time I left on my own. And the way that I guess I went about it I just was in a hospital waiting room one day, figuring out what my next steps were in life. And I had the thought that I really wanted to go to Scotland. And I thought, why? What is stopping me from going to Scotland? And I was like, well, nothing. I mean, I got this real estate, but I don't really want to do it anymore. What is stopping me? And then after I convinced myself that there was nothing stopping me, within 20 minutes, I bought a one-way ticket to Scotland. And it was amazing. Backpacked through there, met a bunch of people from Europe through there, doing this like 100-mile trek through the West Highland Way that I'd never even heard of until like pretty much a week or two before I left. And after that experience, and it's only, you know, people are like, oh, Scotland. And it's not like it's that vastly different. I mean, they have vastly more rich history, I guess, than the US. So you can feel that and you can see that. But other than that, you know, it's pretty much the same culture. But even still, it was so amazing that I haven't really gone back since that day.
Hmm. Do you feel like it was sort of a kind of a baby step? You know, languages, I mean, obviously there are different accents and things, but do you feel like you felt comfortable saying, okay, I speak English, I'm going to an English speaking country? It was like an entry point into yep. kind of going abroad by yourself.
100%. I mean, so my next step, well, I guess I went a bit through Bali, but next was Australia, but literally because there was a fear. And although I've been through Italy and Spain now, there's a giant fear of how do you communicate when they don't speak English? But, you know, I did find out throughout all of my travels that you can get by, especially in kind of those more popular areas, any place that you go, unless you're going off the beaten path really far, you're going to be able to speak English and get away with it. So that's nice, but definitely that was the reason for Scotland, a little bit of the heritage as well for my family, and then Australia after that. So
that's so cool. Okay. So can you talk a little bit about how apply for visas and sort of deal? And I recognize that, you know, with a US passport, we're very lucky. I mean, we sometimes don't recognize how difficult it is for people from many, many countries around the world to secure even a tourist visa to another country, right? There's interviews, there's showing that you're not going to stay for a long period of time. I mean, so I do recognize that we have that privilege of having a wonderful passport for the most part. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, what was your experience, or did you have any sort of challenges or even just any thoughts about the process of applying for different tourist visas? Or I think you mentioned in a previous conversation that you were in Australia on a work holiday, which basically allows you to kind of legally work there as a foreign national. So I don't know, what was that process like and kind of how did that influence you at all, if it did?
Yeah, so tourist visas are pretty much nothing. I mean, when I went to UK, you could stay up for 6 months, and that I only bought a one way, which I think you're supposed to buy a way back. But when I talked to the person stamping my passport as I came in, she said, "How long are you going to be here?" I was like, "I don't know," and she was like, "All right, but you're leaving." I was like, mm-hmm. And she let me in. So that was my experience in the UK. In Bali, it was very easy as well, which is the main. I went to Lombok as well, but that was, I think you only get 3 months there. And again, I should know this. I told you this the other day. I should know the answer to this, but you get whatever it is. It's not that you have to apply and do all these things like register or anything with the passport that we have in the US. For Australia, that's almost a bit of what led me to realize that there's an industry, especially in Europe, for what we're doing now, because Australia was ridiculously easy in regards to applying. You just submit all your documents online. They give it to you. They give you an answer. I think I got my answer within 24 hours that I was accepted. I went there, and because I already had my visa, I could do anything pretty much. I could get, you had to set up a bank account, but then, you know, it's very easy. And it's the second you land, you're good to go. And then if we move forward to Italy and Spain, it is the most complex and backwards system in regards to how to go about acquiring a visa. And like, to sum it up, my girlfriend is Italian. I have a partner visa with her, but it's easier to get a partnership visa in Spain than Italy, for whatever reason. So even though she's an Italian national, I can come to Spain and get a partnership visa easier than I could in Italy. So,
and that's because the different countries have different requirements.
No.
Is this an EU-wide partner visa?
So I can live in Spain. but I'm able to travel throughout the EU. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But essentially, because this was a bit during the COVID time. And so it was, if we were to apply for a partnership visa for Italy, I would have had to go back to the US, which I didn't want to do for a number of reasons during COVID, kind of the tail end. As opposed to Spain, we could go there. She could apply to get her, you know, European NIE card is what it is in Spain. And then
what is that, just for listeners who might not know?
It's essentially a card that allows somebody from Italy to come live and work. It's like, I mean, we don't have it in the US because we can go to Kansas or New York or right. Hawaii and just set up shop. But here, if you're a national, all you have to do is apply. And it's pretty easy, especially for her. I mean, she had to set up a meeting and that was it. But that's it allows them to live and work.
Got it. Okay. So from different EU states, countries to go. Yeah. Okay. So now you've traveled, you did the work holiday in Australia, obviously met somebody who's an Italian. And so now you're able to apply for this sort of partner visa, which is really cool that they have that. Mm-hmm. Where did this concept of citizen remote, and we'll get to what the company, you know, what the vision is and what the company does now, and obviously where you're built, what you're building, but this concept of, all right, I want to spend my professional life, for now at least, you know, building a tech enabled or a tech solution for this sort of digital nomad kind of cross-border visa situation. What led you to start thinking in that direction? And then I want to get into sort of, you know, how you built the company and how you found your co-founder. But, you know, you first had to have that idea of like, I could do this. I could build something here.
So I think it comes down to just circumstance. I was living in Spain. I had been doing a few other like kind of entrepreneurial consulting and like some other side stuff, but it wasn't as like sustainable long-term for what, and just not really what I wanted. I was still looking for that kind of project that I initially left the US for. And the circumstance was, all right, in Spain, I don't speak Spanish very well. I speak better Italian than Spanish, which is fun to communicate to people. And not only that, but in the area that I'm in, it's Catalonian. So I definitely don't speak that. And so I was in that situation where once I get my visa, which took 9 months to get for me to be able to work, I can't walk into like any place in which I have experience and say, hey, can I work there? Because it would be difficult for me to ask that. So I realized, okay, I need to be able to find something that enables me to work remotely internationally, because like I want to continue to travel. And from that, I discovered these digital nomad visas. And this was kind of like, they had been around. So like Portugal had been around, but they'd really blossomed since early, 2020, since COVID, and they were popping up like crazy. There's a few more. Costa Rica today just officially launched theirs because they had announced that they were going to today. They just launched theirs. And I realized after market research, there's no one in this space doing what it is that I want to do. And at that point, I just went full in, found my partner, and we can talk about that. And now we're here.
So you said that you did market research and you saw that no one was doing what you wanted to do in the space. So what is that? What was that thing that you wanted to do in the space? What were you looking for that was missing?
So the biggest, competitors that I found that were kind of close was people who would say, hey, we'll get you to come over here for this country and then we'll help you move to another. It's like travel, kind of long holiday stays, but no one was really helping people relocate. Like no one was helping people who have remote jobs, who have income, who are eligible, relocate to another place because
relocate via a digital nomad visa.
Correct. Yes. So like if you want to open up a business, you know, that's not necessarily our expertise. We can point you in the right direction, but for the digital nomad visas, and especially when you're considering going to Greece or Croatia or Portugal, it's complex. Sometimes you need power of attorneys. Like there's a lot of stuff to do and it's not always straightforward. And so I realized that there's a bunch of opportunity for us to assist people in that. And there was one or two maybe that had like a country specific. So like if it's Portugal, oh, we can help with just Portugal, but none of them really encompassed, hey, come here, we can point you wherever you want to go and we can figure out what works best for you. And that's what we've designed and have developed.
And I guess the idea would be that if a digital nomad wants to move from one country to another, instead of now going on another search to find another provider for that second or third country they want to go to, the idea would be kind of a centralized hub for all of their, if you can call this, digital nomad visa needs.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So, I mean, we expect just quickly to help people, like you were saying, relocate from year to year if they want to, but then also once they get in country to help them set up in country. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the early stages of all that, but that's our long-term goal for sure.
And so what, so you had this idea, you do the market research, you see an opportunity, the sort of the entrepreneur brain, right? Like fires up and you're like, hold on a second. I know this. I am passionate about travel at this point in my life, and I see an opportunity, like, let me explore building a business. So what was the first thing? Because I know that you have a co-founder now, but initially you were doing this, or you were thinking about or taking those first steps on your own. So I think this is a crucial question, because if I can go back to the crux of this entire podcast, this entire show, it is to get into the mind of people within our industry who are building businesses and really try to tease out what drove them to, leave their job or, leave the comfort of their home or whatever it might be and start something within this industry. Because, this industry is fantastic and it's global and it touches a lot of people, but it's not top of the news feed, of like the coolest or sexiest industry to be in. And so I think for somebody to want to build something in here, it's not because they read about Tesla being a $750 billion company. Don't quote me on that number. I'm just pulling it out of thin air.
But, probably not
wrong. And saying like, oh, I want a piece of that pie. It's really typically from some personal experience. So, but then you have to take that first step. You have a business background and an accounting background. You've traveled, you've had entrepreneurial endeavors. What was that first step that you took towards like putting this into into the world?
You're not asking how, like, my motivation behind it, or you're saying what was the first initial step?
What was that first step? If you're a developer, for example, you might start wireframing an app because that's how your mind thinks. If you are a consultant, then you might say, all right, let me put together a global digital nomad visa consulting package. What was that first step that you took to turn this from just general concept into the beginnings of a business?
So the first step was, again, kind of finding those that seeing if there's competitors, seeing if it's even viable, seeing if what I'm going to create is already off and running. And I found out that it wasn't. So I started blasting out a bunch of kind of self-made surveys to as many people as I knew to see if there was a market, to see if people wanted to do it. So I think I ended up creating like a 30-page marketing research, just for example, of what I was doing kind of the setup. And then within that marketing research and kind of getting that, I was already kind of geared towards that international consulting entrepreneurially via what I was doing kind of on the side. So it was kind of an easy transition from that international lens to, okay, now I'm just going to help people relocate internationally. And so as I was doing that transition, I came across someone by the name of Peter, and Peter Gretel, and he was doing one company that was doing almost exactly what I was doing, except he was about 2 or 3 months ahead of me. And so I saw that and I said, well, this is exactly it. I kept scrolling, like, because I'd found a few and then I realized that it wasn't what I was doing. And then the more I realized, I said, man, you are on to exactly what I'm doing. So it was one of those things that I literally clicked on the little message box that popped up, messaged them. And I asked just a general, hey, I really like what you guys are doing in the process of developing the same thing. Do you guys have a big team? Do you guys have funding? What's going on? And Peter reached out, hey, I'm the founder. We're a pretty small team. What's up? And I said, well, man, I'd love to have a chat. We scheduled a chat and we kind of took off from there and we realized we have the same vision. We kind of can join teams and went from there.
That's so cool. I'm curious, what was he building? What was he building at the time? Like, what did you see? What did you come across when you went to their website?
Yeah, so he kind of, the way he designed it was he had a lot of content. So what he did was he had a lot of traffic, which is the one thing, because he's marketing background and he's like very good at marketing. And so that was a really good complement of what I do, which is kind of developing the partnerships and kind of driving the revenue aspect of the business. And then he was also developing an app. And with those two things, the content and the app and how he wanted to take that direction, I noticed that he hit all of the essential relocation kind of assistance. And from that, I realized that he is pretty much on the cusp of what I'm doing. So then after a few conversations, kind of he shared his vision, I shared my vision. And it was just one of those things that they literally complemented so perfectly, because the few things that I was missing and the few things that he was missing just put us on that path. We're growing quite rapidly and we're set up for hopefully a good next year.
That's awesome. That's so cool. What was it like when you, this might be a very nuanced question, but what was it like when you decided, okay, we're both building something in this space that's quite new, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Dealing with digital nomad visas and sort of providing information, building a global partnership network, building some sort of an app, you know, community, et cetera. How did you join forces? Quite practically, you know, from whatever you could share, because it's almost like a very, very early stage merger, because I think it would just be interesting to know, kind of just change your email. Do you create a separate, like a third brand that wasn't either of the two that existed?
So no, I'm very risk on. I'm not very risk averse, I guess. I am okay with the risk. And so I'll say that to start off. But also another thing that was very funny, and it just seemed like we had the right path, was one of the podcasts that I had was called Thoughts of a Random Citizen. It was early, and don't go listen to it if you're curious. But so the fact that I had Thoughts of a Random Citizen and his company was called Citizen Remote, and we were building the same thing, in my mind, I'm a very gut centric, and meaning listen to my gut and just go with it, take that step and see what happens. And because of that, I was like, I'm going to take a chance on this. And he was a bit more reserved, because I reached out to him. You know, he had a bit other projects that he wasn't able to dedicate full time. And I said, no worries, let me just take the helm and I'll push us in the direction that you want to go and I want to go. And then after that conversation, a few chats like we're doing now, we got to where we're at and we talked consistently all day, but he's actually coming in next week for the first time. So we're going to meet in person. So I haven't even met the guy in person.
Wow, no kidding. And where is he based right now?
Denmark. So that was also something. He's from North Carolina. Oh, wait, South Carolina. He'll kill me if he listens to this, because I forget every time. But he's from one of the Carolinas. And the fact that he was also an expat in Europe was, it just seemed like everything was hitting the way that conversations when meeting someone should go. And so we kind of set up a little bit of a, let's see how this goes after a few months and then we can reevaluate. And it went well. And now we're here.
Amazing. Excited about you guys finally meeting soon.
Yeah.
So I think this would be a great time for me to ask you, what is Citizen Remote, right? We've sort of talked around like what you were experiencing traveling around the world and I'm applying for different types of visas and obviously hitting onto this really now just at the very early stages industry of digital nomad visas, right? As we become more remote as a workforce around the world and building something, right? You were both building something. I understand that at the early stages, it's vague. Like it, even if you have a vision, sometimes it feels like imposter syndrome, where you actually have a really articulated way of explaining your vision, well articulated way, but it's like scary almost to say it out loud. It feels like,
the right one?
Right. Is this the right one? Are people going to take me seriously? Is this going to sound ridiculous? It's easy to write it off as like, oh, I'm working on a little project, or like, I'm just thinking about something, you know, versus saying I have a company that does X. Now, I know you guys are at your early stages right now, but what can you share about what Citizen Remote basically does today or is going to do today when you launch soon? Like, what can you give an idea of what that is?
Yeah. So what I should say is we are the ultimate digital nomad resource for those thinking internationally. But what that means is we're essentially an international digital nomad community that helps people relocate wherever there are digital nomad visas. Mm-hmm. And then from that relocation, we intend on helping set up with real estate, with taxes, pretty much all of the initial onboarding requirements when moving to a new country that you're inevitably going to have to face, whether that be health insurance, whether that be getting a SIM card, whether that be, you know, utilities, which those are a bit further down the line. But that's where we envision Citizen Remote helping people in 5 years, 10 years.
So can you talk a little bit about what do you have right now? So you have a, you know, do you have a network of countries that you can help people apply for a digital nomad visa at? Can, do you have community? Like if I am interested, and I frankly actually kind of am, so perhaps this is a selfish question, but if I'm interested in moving to, like you said, Portugal or Greece or something for 6 months or a year via the digital nomad visa, and I visit Citizen Remote, what can I get?
Yeah, so we essentially help you with that process from start to finish. So, and we don't, to answer the first question, we have pretty much every digital nomad visa that you might see, hear about, we offer. So as I just said earlier, Costa Rica just launched today. We already can help you with that via our partnerships. So we essentially have a team in every country that we work with that helps you relocate from start to finish, whether that be scheduling like consultations or at the consulates, or whether that be scheduling meetings at the consulates, whether that be translating documents, whether that be getting help with setting up in the country with specific real estate, we can help facilitate that transition to any digital nomad visa country.
And do you have, because I think I saw something about community on the company website, do you have any sort of like a Facebook group or anything where people who are interested in or are already utilizing a digital nomad visa can connect with one another and share tips or stories or whatnot?
So we have a Facebook group, yes. However, we are about a month away from the app. So if you do go and get on the Facebook group, you get lifetime access to our app. So that's great because it will be $99 a year eventually. But we do have quite a large community that comes just across our site. So our traffic is quite high and we're growing. I think it's like 18,000 month over month right now, and we're growing at 60%. So, and that's completely organic. And that's kind of comes from that content. So as the Facebook community is quite small right now, our main focus is on building this app. So then people wanting to relocate, wanting to know where to go, the hotspots, where digital nomads are at in Portugal, what to do when in Portugal, how to connect with digital nomads in Portugal can all happen within the app. So the app is really cool. And if you're interested in the app, head over to citizenremote.com and you can find it's, we promote it everywhere. So and you can kind of explore what the features are going to be of that app. So that is the community.
And is this going to be a mobile app or a sort of on the web or both?
Both. Yeah, it's going to be iOS as of, fingers crossed, August 1st. I probably shouldn't say that deadline, but okay. if you know development, you'll know. But it'll be iOS to start, and then we'll go Android, and then it'll be a desktop version. But yeah, it's just going to be mobile but desktop.
Got it. And so would people also be able to log into this effectively through the website? Like, do you get a login or it is a standalone app from the website?
We'll probably be able to do that. Yeah. I mean, it won't be it is a standalone app from the website. Yes, 100%. So you're going to go to the app store and you're going to download it. But whether we enable that kind of like community within the website, that's something to consider. I imagine, I don't see why we wouldn't do that. All the content and everything that we offer, kind of that free information that we kind of allow people to see and decide if they want to apply on their own is going to be still within the app, within the website. So
that's awesome. And so I guess, where do you see, you know, what do you think is going to be next? I understand that you guys are launching soon. I'm sure you have a million things going on and a ton of ideas. And, you know, listen, I've been there. I've had ideas for our company that didn't come to fruition. So no one's going to hold you to this, but I guess, what are some of the things that you're thinking about or excited about from the digital nomad visa space? Because the world is talking about this quote unquote future of work, which is here. I mean, it's not the future. It is the present. There are many people, there are a lot of gig workers that make good money that can work, you know, remotely and leverage digital nomad visa. There are many corporate employees whose companies allow them to work anywhere. And obviously, digital nomad visas make that possible from an immigration, you know, tax legal standpoint. What do you see as the sort of the future of where digital nomad visas are going? And I guess, are you aligning that vision with kind of the roadmap for the company?
Yeah, 100%. So I hate to say that I don't want to give a vision because there's a quote by like Gary Vaynerchuk. And it's if I have good ideas, I shout them because I'm not going to hold on to my ideas selfishly. I'd rather someone create it than no one create it. Mm-hmm. However, we are going to create it. So it's like I'm in that debate of what to do. But I guess, yeah, it really is. We're focused on how we're going to facilitate that relocation. And so it's based on those partnerships that we're creating. It's based on making that process so seamless, like I was talking about Australia and how I literally got to Australia and was good to go from the first step. And essentially, we're doing that in some places a lot easier to do that, but we're wanting to make sure that we can do that in places that it's not very easy to do that. For example, Portugal, where you might have to get like a rental contract. But then to get a rental contract, you have to have a certain document. But then to have that certain document, you have to have this. And so there's a lot of complexities that I think we can help ease, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sometimes it's a matter of putting something into a nice interface and giving people steps along the way and updates. And you know, you can't change the process because that's
exactly.
Portugal law, but you can make the process of complying with that easier.
And I think that there's a really cool application of, and obviously this is longer term and how we're going to apply it, but enable like having that central hub and whether it be some form of partnership with the country in which we're saying to allow us to have those documents and act as that proof, not proof of work, but to say, okay, well, now that we've done this, we have this here, you know, the rest is good. Let them do this because you can see that they're on this. Does that make sense? I know I said this and that a lot.
I think so. I guess if somebody's using your platform, it legitimizes their application or something like that, because then maybe you've built partnerships over time. These government agencies see that you guys are legitimately helping strong applicants. And so if it comes through you, maybe that gives it a little bit more
streamline the process.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess legitimacy is one way, but then also just that ease of access to allow them to see the documentation, whether that means we submit it. And yeah, but I mean, I think this whole space is, you know, I wouldn't say ripe for disruption, but the way that some of these other nomad visa countries are enabling kind of how quickly that process is compared to like Portugal, who's a bit behind because they were kind of the first ones to develop this, as opposed to now when they've had it and they're considering like revamping it a bit because it is a bit more of that kind of backward.
What do you see is the incentive for countries to create a digital nomad visa?
Yeah. So, I mean, in my thought is I don't know why any country wouldn't, unless they're overpopulated, in which obviously, you know, that's a different conversation, but it helps the economy because the people that are relocating already have a job. They already have income somewhere else. So they're coming in there, whether they're building more helping the real estate market by building more properties to support them, whether they're spending more money at local restaurants for an entire year, as opposed to just like right now, I'm in Spain and the amount of people that are in Spain over the past few months is insane compared to December, you know, so that economy boost long term. And not only that, but kind of that cultural mesh, I think, are the benefits of bringing the international community a bit closer, a bit more understanding of one another, when you can go and easily live and not drain their economy, but support their economy.
Do you see that, you know, some countries are making it easier because they want to leverage that ease to get people there? Or do you just think it's easier because, well, all right, we saw how Portugal did it. They were the first. Let's learn from their process and let's make our process better. Or maybe it's a combination of both. It'd be easy for me to say, well, maybe if you're Greece, you might want people to come a little bit more so than if you're Switzerland, because just where the economy is, you know, et cetera. Do you think the ease of the process is correlated at all with, to put it crudely, how badly the country may want to bring people in? Or do you think it's really just kind of random or something else?
And I honestly haven't even considered that. It would make sense that, you know, if you want people to have to jump through a few more hoops because we're not as badly needing you, then, well, yeah, I mean, make the process a bit more difficult. But for example, I know Italy and Spain are on the cusp of releasing theirs. It's yet to be known how easy they're going to be. I know financially, they're both, I mean, a bit better than Greece from my experience. But I think for based on what you said, I would imagine Italy's is a bit more difficult and Spain's is a bit easier if we're going from what you said, because, you know, it would make sense to allow them to come in easier to support that economy as opposed to making it super complex. Yeah. But I've just been through the Spanish visa and I don't know if it's going to be very easy.
And maybe it has on the, and I'm just curious kind of what you were seeing on the ground, obviously, who knows? So it's easy to superimpose some sort of reasoning behind something, but like sometimes it's just random, you know, governments do whatever feels is appropriate at the time and isn't really based on any like broader strategy sometimes. Okay. And so I guess, you know, to wrap up, I'm curious, you know, where you see the digital nomad visa process going. I mean, you're obviously, you know, Costa Rica launched today. You mentioned Spain and Italy are launching. Do you think that this will eventually be a worldwide phenomenon? Do you think that as some companies are actually pushing back, saying, actually, we want you back in the office, like, do you think that might recede a little bit? And I know that wouldn't be great for you because your business, at least for now, is going to be growing as the digital nomad visa scheme grows around the world. But like, what are you seeing based on your conversations with partners around the world and kind of being in the thick of this aspect of immigration?
Well, I mean, I think that as companies do push back, they're going to see a bit of a talent drain, which is probably something that everyone is aware of, is that when you have the ability to move around the world, and not necessarily everyone wants to, but to have that availability, to have a company that says, hey, you can live wherever you want and we'll support you with it, then that is going to, in my opinion, attract much more people, especially when I get to open that door right there and my girlfriend's right there and she works remotely from home all day. It's nice. We get lunch every day. You know, we can go out when we want. I have the responsibility to finish and complete my work when I want. So there is that. I can understand why companies would want to bring people back in. But I think that it's just inevitable that we're going to be in 10 years where 1 billion people are working remotely, which is all right for my industry.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, do you see more companies allowing full-time employees to use the digital nomad visa to travel or live abroad? Or do you see more like sort of solo or entrepreneurs or just freelancers using the visa? Or maybe there's no trend really that you're seeing yet.
So I don't necessarily see a trend. We are reaching out to some of those fully remote companies to see if they want to offer their employees access to Citizen Remote and the services we provide. So that is a focus, is reaching out to those companies that are saying, you know, you guys can choose. And I think that's and what will eventually happen is that companies will say it's a choice as opposed to it's all remote or it's all in office. It'll be that choice. But like logistically, like overhead wise, it makes more sense to allow your employees to work remotely because you don't have to get that $6 billion Google facility that is really cool and would be sweet. But, you know, there's none of that kind of big city high rise rent that you have to pay.
That's great. And again, I mean, I think it's a wonderful idea. I also recognize, I think a lot of countries have recognized that freelancers come in and they work, you know, and they're not taking a job. They're not taking a local job. They're not, but they're working for themselves. But the internet allows you to, you know, jump into your Google Drive and upload your YouTube videos and, you know, make money off of that or do travel consulting or whatever, right? Like people do this and they do this on, you know, many people do it on tourist visas, which I think most countries like will turn a blind eye to because you're there for a couple of weeks, you know, you're doing a few things. They may allow it. They may just not find it too disruptive. But how great would it be to make it official and, you know, track how many people are coming into your country for to be able to work for themselves, how long they're staying and sort of, you know, maybe move the economy in a way forward that supports that. I think it would be great. And I do hope every country or if not most countries do this. Because heck, I would love to be able to, if I can, you know, go live in, I don't know, where, anywhere, let's say Italy, because I was just there recently. I'd love to live there for 6 months and be able to, you know, to work fully and freely and, you know that I'm complying with every law and regulation and sort of see the world that way. So I'm hoping for a similar future as you, man, honestly.
Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, obviously money is what makes the world go around. So it has to be financially smart for countries to want to do this, which it seems as though it is. But it goes back to that cultural kind of integration with each other is once you live in a place like Italy, you don't view Italy like you used to view Italy. You view it completely differently. It's the same with Spain. It's the same with Estonia or Malta. You go to these places and you realize, wow, this is not what I expected. This is great. Like the culture's this way and you learn. And yeah, I mean, I think that is the biggest benefit of these digital nomad visas, which is kind of the unspoken of this international community that could be had.
Yeah, you don't see Italy as just the Colosseum and pasta anymore. You see it as a place where people live and families raise and their kids live. And, you know, that you live. And yeah, exactly. We do have one comment here I want to bring up. So Seth Feinberg, immigration attorney, says, a client of mine considered a digital nomad visa for one of their new employees. So I guess the client is an employer, but we ended up finding another immigration option. I bet we will revisit this possibility in the future. So Seth, you know, if you're watching, reach out to Tim or Tim, reach out to Seth. I mean, at the very least, right, for I think immigration lawyers, one of the big reasons I love digital nomad visas, and I actually have talked about them when I'm on certain panels and different conferences, is that I think companies are underutilizing them. They don't realize that they can use them for their employees. So I think it's a really wonderful option for, you know, corporate HR and whatnot to leverage for their employees who want to move travel abroad. A lot of times companies think, oh, well, we have these employees, especially, let's be honest, you know, millennial Gen Z employees who really do want to see the world early in their career, but we don't have an office in country X or region Y. Well, guess what? You don't need to, right? Go through any sort of crazy like global payroll provider or whatever. Yep. I mean, maybe there are options and instances where that's the case if someone wants to truly relocate there for many years. But if they want to go for 6 months or a year, they can leverage a digital nomad visa and have a much easier path. So I suspect that in time, more and more companies will be leveraging this. And once one of the big players does it and paves the way from a sort of internal procedural and process standpoint, mm-hmm. For smaller companies to do it, hopefully it'll really catch on.
Yeah. Yeah. And then just to piggyback on that, the taxes as well, you know, that's something that companies kind of worry about. But with these digital nomad visas, they're designed as a way to not have to worry about that.
Right.
So, yeah,
there you go.
It's an exciting future.
So Tim, as we, you know, wrap up here, I'm curious to kind of end on a more adventurous note. But you sort of traveled, you know, you travel all around the world now. You've been in multiple continents and seen a lot of different places. If I had to like just wake you up in the middle of the night and say, all right, what was that one travel memory that's really stuck with you? And, you know, as maybe as someone who grew up in the Midwest and you had the upbringing and life in America that you did, what was something that really kind of profoundly, a moment or a travel experience that really, I think, changed you and made you kind of, I guess, who you are today?
I wouldn't say, well, if there's one memory that I always think about that made me realize I don't want to stop doing what I'm doing and meaning traveling, mm-hmm. It was on my first ever trip through Scotland. I was on the top of this West Highland Way, which is like the top of this mountain. It was like Mount Cooney or something, or Coonley, or, but anyways, on the West Highland Way. And I was standing up there and it was just like this typical, you think of it in like this old Scottish movie where I'm on top of this mountain. The fog is like beneath me, but then above me, and it's really fast. And there's a little bit of rain coming down. And I was just sitting there with like my backpack on this hike. And I just like took it in. And it was one of the most memorable kind of experiences. And I've had a bunch, and I've had, you know, maybe more lasting ones. But just to think of, to answer that question, that's the first thing that popped into my mind. And I said, this is amazing. And I want to see and view and experience the beauty of the world. So
that's cool, man. I love that. I hope you can. And I want to get back out there into the world too. So, Tim, thank you so much. I know it's evening there in Spain, so go enjoy some wine, Spanish wine or beer or whatever. And yeah, thanks again, man. This is really exciting. Good luck to you guys, really. And I'm excited to keep watching the growth and where, you know, Citizen Remote is going, and maybe have you back on the show sometime in the future to share updates and challenges and sort of where you are at that time. So in the meantime, thanks again. Again, really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thanks, Roman, so much. Thanks for having me on the show, man. I couldn't thank you enough.
Awesome. Appreciate it.